Hello and welcome to another episode of The Foxhole Companion with me, Dan Stewart.
And me, Simon Rance.
So this week, Simon, we take to the skies.
We do, with the Battle of Britain, a 1969 masterclass in ensemble casting.
Yeah, and actual planes flying as well.
Yeah, and it looks absolutely amazing. I'm sure we'll get to that.
We love this film, though, don't we?
Well, do you know...
Oh, have you changed your mind?
No, I loved it, but yeah. I wasn't looking forward to it too much because I remembered thinking it was meh when I was younger compared to some other like ripping yarns and things like that.
Yeah.
You know.
You know why, right?
Why?
Because not enough machine guns and tanks and things.
There's no tanks, is there?
No.
I like tanks.
You do like tanks.
But no, rewatching it together, but we were hollering, we were shouting.
Hollering.
It was amazing. It's a proper old school war movie.
Now, I would imagine there aren't too many Brits, and we were talking about this, weren't we, Simon, whether how big a hit this was in America or even to this day, if it's even properly, you know, acknowledged as a classic war film America, because there's no Yanks in it.
No, that's right. And you can tell, like, it would have been, you know, eaten up by the British public and loved. But, yeah, we were talking whether or not it was a hit overseas, because obviously to us, the Battle of Britain is gargantuan.
Indeed. And it's an interesting question, because I think that it might have been a bit more of a hit than we're giving it credit for, just because... of the cast list, which is
crazy.
It's sort of insane.
Yeah.
I mean, we've yet to come to the classic epic ones like A Bridge Too Far. I think everybody's in that.
Yeah. So this film has a ridiculously talented list of actors in its cast.
Let's just
go through a few of them. You say one, I'll say the next.
Harry Andrews.
I can't believe you started with him. I mean, yeah, he's a good actor, but these people that are in it, you start with Harry Andrews.
Look, in credits order.
Okay.
So that's who they thought was most important.
No way.
All right, let's start with Michael Caine.
There you go. Trevor Howard.
Kurt Jurgens.
Why are you going there again?
It's amazing.
Yeah, but you've got like Laurence Olivier.
All right, fucking do it again. Michael Caine.
Trevor Howard.
Ian McShane.
Kenneth Moore.
Laurence Olivier, people.
Christopher Plummer.
Nigel Patrick. He's famous.
He's not Robert Shaw, though, is he?
Fucking hell.
No, this is brilliant. This has got to stay in. Anyway,
there's more. I'll do them then.
Edward Fox.
Robert Shaw. Ralph Richardson. Michael Redgrave. Susanna York. Patrick Weimark. And
Christopher Plummer,
and let's not forget my favourite, Harry Andrews.
And the film was directed by Guy Hamilton, probably apart from this movie, best known for four Bond movies.
Bond movies, ladies and gents.
Yeah, the first one he did was the fourth Bond movie, a cracker, Goldfinger, a lot of people's favourite.
Yeah.
The second Bond movie he did is Your Guilty Pleasure, Diamonds Are Forever.
I do love that. It is a horrible film. It's terrible, but
there's parts of it that are good.
I kind of love it.
Bambi and Thumper at the swimming pool beating him up is pretty good.
That's great. And the two bad guys, Mr. Jones and Mr. Smith, hilarious.
Is it Mr. Jones and Mr. Smith?
It's something like that, though, isn't it?
I don't think it is. They're hilarious, and they're not doing much for the woke movement as we speak. The third Bond movie he did was Roger Moore's debut as 007, Live and Let Die.
Which, the less said, the better.
Again, during woke, should be banned. And then The Man with the Golden Gun, the Bond film where not a lot happens.
Nothing happens really at all.
No. So, but apart from that, he did Funeral in Berlin prior to making Battle of Britain. He also did another film which we will cover at some point, Force 10 from Navarone.
Which is a great one.
Yeah, the sequel to The Guns of Navarone. He did...
Is that Edward Fox as well?
Edward Fox is in Falls Turn from Navarone, yeah.
And Harrison Ford.
And Robert Shaw.
And Robert Shaw again.
So yeah. Robert Shaw and Foxy Baby are in this too. So they all probably met, had far too many pints of ale.
Oh, can you imagine the drinking on that one?
Whiskey sours on the lash in some sort of thatched, beautiful pub.
Poor Harrison Ford probably didn't know what happened to him.
No.
Especially it's also because it's Anthony Quinn as well, right?
Oh, yeah. No, that's the Guns of Navarone.
Oh, that's the Guns of Navarone. Yeah. The drinking that was going on. No, Jesus.
It would have been nice to have been a runner on that film.
Now, before we get to the ins and outs of this brilliant, fabulous and entertaining film, we're going to do Dan's pocket history.
Okay.
Of the Battle of Britain. So where we left you, Foxhole fans, was the rather dispiriting British Army evacuating from Dunkirk. And we watched that in the two films titled Dunkirk. But the Battle of Britain, the film, finds us in the summer and late summer of 1940. What's happened in between? Well, Churchill's been elected Prime Minister.
Yeah.
Which is sort of quite important.
Pretty important.
And we should say at this point, Foxhole fans, Simon and I did debate for a little while as to whether or not we should postpone Battle of Britain for a week and do the Gary Oldman film, The Darkest Hour, which sort of covers the election of Churchill, Dunkirk, and the Battle of Britain. But we decided against it. We'll probably do it as a bonus episode. We'll probably refer to it. We'll give it a watch.
Yeah, I think it has to be included. But we, you know, we've stressed a few times that we don't want to just cover films about the war.
Right.
We want to cover war films.
Yeah. And obviously by Dan's rating of what constitutes a war film.
It's Darkest Hour certainly wouldn't have been.
It's a rom-com.
It would have been pretty in pink too. So, so we've steered clear of it because I can't have him moaning anymore about, it's about time we're finally when he does his usual, we're now finally watching a proper war film.
Yeah. So, a very odd thing happened, which the British can probably be quite thankful for, is the Germans got to the coast of France and looked through their binoculars, and 25 odd miles away was the White Cliffs of Dover. And for some reason, best known unto themselves, Hitler decided to have a little holiday, see a bit of Paris. I mean, I think they even refer to it in the film.
Yeah.
I think some vice air admirals are going, well, it's a bloody good thing that Hitler decided to have his jollies in Paris.
Yeah, and then Olivier goes, well, it is rather nice weather.
That's true. And he didn't invade when the entire British Army and British Navy and British Air Force was in complete disarray. He stopped.
Mm. Well, isn't it the fact that he stopped or sort of waited? Well, he thought he was being canny because he was like, right, we've brought the threat to their to their doorstep.
That's it.
Now it's time for them to make a deal with us.
Yeah.
So we don't have to invade.
Yeah. I think he was canny enough to know that wouldn't be a walkover, like say, I don't know, Czechoslovakia had been. However, he must have thought, I mean, historians have several beliefs on this. One is that he thought that the British would go, all right, you've kicked our ass, let's call it a truce and come up with some sort of agreement, right, of surrender. Another one is that he thought that, I can't imagine why, the very British and utterly not German royal family would be like, please come on in. We love you. You're great. But that didn't happen either. And what did happen is there was a space of about 4 weeks. Generally, it's considered that the Battle of Britain began on the 10th of July. And the last day of Dunkirk was the 4th of June. So you've got a little over a month there, which sounds like nothing. And my God, when you're looking at the scenes in Kabul today and how they're struggling just to get a few thousand people out of an airport, it is sort of astonishing what the British managed to achieve in a month, because basically what they did is they went on this hyper-industrial drive, which ended with them at the height of Battle of Britain making 300 aeroplanes a week. They went mad training every person they could find and calling in every air reserve pilot they could find and giving them a fighter plane, basically.
But that's, more important. That's right. There was some in the documentary I watched about it, the World War II in colour one that's available on Netflix. There's a chap who's interviewed in that, and he leaves boarding school and gets in a Spitfire.
Amazing.
I mean, terrifying.
It really was sort of backs against the wall, Britain. And there was an interesting line in the last Dunkirk we watched between Bernard Lee
and John Mills.
And John Mills, where John Mills says to Bernard Lee, are we going to be all right? And he goes, yeah, I think if we get the best men for the job, we will be. And amazingly, it seems to have happened.
Fighter Command came up with this incredible plan
to not just create fighters and pilots, but they created an early warning system that didn't exist anywhere on the planet yet, which was basically a sort of 3 or 4 tiered radar across the whole southern and northeastern part of Britain. And it was an early warning device. Originally, they had these weird, huge concrete, if you imagine a ball cut in half, but a huge concrete ball cut in half, and they could hear an aeroplane from 20, 30 miles away. But that ended up being quickly obsolete, and they came up with these the radar stations. And they could track planes from the coast of France, which gave them about a 15-minute head start.
But it has given us a chance to pull ourselves together and to train people like you. Now, as fighter controllers, you'll be joining an organization which, thank the good Lord, was not rushed up hastily yesterday. It'll be a pain in the neck to the enemy when he comes. It's the joker up our sleeves. Now, the RDF chain shows us where they are. The information is passed to group. Group scrambles the necessary squadrons. And you, at sector level, guide our chaps to the interception. It's been tried and tested. It works. So don't blame the system if you're no good.
They basically sort of cut the southeast of Britain into quarters. And each station was put on high alert depending on where the enemy was coming from. And you had, obviously, an HQ where they plot the... you've all seen this in the films, and it's in this film lots, where RAF officers were pushing across little markers on a huge map of southern Britain and northern France of planes coming in and out. And they would send up the fighters, they would intercept the German bombers and try and shoot them down. The Germans underestimated how successful this radar coverage would be, even beyond the Battle of Britain. They never quite worked out how the British were managing to achieve what they achieved.
Yeah, that's right, because they obviously had radar themselves, but unlike them, the Dowding system didn't just have radar. It had the 30,000 volunteers, right? The Observer Corps.
Yeah, old fellas in a dugout on the coast with a pair of binoculars.
But pair of binoculars and a pantograph.
Yeah.
So they would then call in the height of the planes.
Yeah, and what sort of planes they were. Because obviously a radar is just a blip. It doesn't tell you what sort of planes they are.
Yeah.
So it was an incredibly simple and really successful levels of protection that the British very quickly came up with. Now, the Germans probably went along with it and decided they liked it because there was this overarching sense amongst the Luftwaffe that they were indestructible, that they were the greatest air force in the world. And they were quite pleased about the fact that the British fighters would come up and attack them because they thought the more they do that, the more we'll shoot down and eventually there won't be any RAF left. And we can invade. This entire thing, the Battle of Britain, was to facilitate the invasion of Britain because Hitler wasn't a complete idiot and he knew that if he attempted to try and cross the Channel with an armada, they would get wiped out long before they got anywhere near any British beaches by the RAF. So all of this sort of reached a height around August the 6th when Germany launched the Alderangriff, the eagle attack. Did you like that pronunciation?
Is that Eagle Day?
Eagle attack.
Okay.
Mm. Where their plan was to destroy the RAF on the ground. And they sent in loads and loads of bombers to all the airfields, and all their bombers got shot down. The other problem the Germans had is there was no consistency. Time and time again, unbeknownst to them, they had the RAF on the ropes, and they didn't think they would last another 12 hours, let alone another day. But every time they got that close, like they nearly had the radar completely put out of action. They nearly had fighter command taken out at one point. They nearly had all the southern airfields put out of action. But they never finished the job, and they would go and bomb something else, and it would give just enough time, sometimes just 6 or 12 hours, where they would repair things and they'd be back to strength again.
And it's really interesting, because that's when propaganda is blinding the Luftwaffe.
Mm.
So you've got the Air Force intelligence officer Schmidt telling Goering, the head of the Luftwaffe and probably Hitler's right-hand man, everything he wanted to hear. I think he was probably so terrified of them, he was basically giving a propaganda amount of how many planes shot down. And because some of his intelligence was so poor that was reported, they never really knew how many times we were on the ropes.
Yeah, no, they didn't. And look, from everything I've read and listened to and watched, I think Hermann Göring was a bit of an idiot. And he was an egotist. And those are two rather sort of catastrophic faults to have. And so much so that he didn't even listen to his own fighter pilots and aces who were coming to him and saying, look, this method we've got isn't really working for us. Because what Göring wanted is he wanted the very powerful and very experienced fighter pilots to basically fly really slowly with the bombers and escort them over their targets. But that meant that they couldn't really do the job that fighters do, which is to surprise planes and come in at high speed and out of the sun and all of that. So they were picked off rather easily by the British fighters. This all reached a height on the 15th of August, which is called the Greatest Day. The Germans decided, again, completely changed tack and decided the British must have shifted all of their fighter planes in the country to the south. So let's go bomb the north.
That's right, they bombed your county.
Yeah, they bombed God's County.
Oh, dear me.
And Manchester. Obviously, you know, not quite so much of a problem. Yeah, I said it. But they bombed Manchester in northern England, or at least that's what they thought they were going to do. And out of 150 planes that attacked Britain, 75 were shot down. And they just got their asses kicked. 3 days later, on August the 18th, was what is described as the hardest day, where both sides suffered the greatest losses. Now, there were a couple of things that were starting to turn the tide of war here. A really important one, and an obvious one, is that the Royal Air Force were fighting, you know, over their own country. It was a home game for them.
Yeah.
Now, this may sound simplistic, but on a morale basis, it's commonly understood that people fighting on their home soil do so with much more conviction, with a seriousness and with a dedication that you wouldn't normally see if they were, you know, just fighting over some foreign field.
Well, yeah, exactly. Or as the Germans were, they were flying from occupied territory where they were loathed.
Where they were hated. And the British were literally flying over their own homes.
Yeah.
And their own towns.
And popping down the local pub.
Yeah.
And being welcomed in as heroes.
Exactly. And furthermore, when they were shot down or they were forced to land, they landed in their own country. So they dropped, you know, took off their parachute, and a couple of hours later, they were in a brand new plane fighting.
Mm.
When the Germans got shot down, they were captured or killed, and they're now one bomber crew or one fighter pilot less than they had before. That doesn't mean there weren't catastrophic losses. On August the 24th, the Luftwaffe focused their raids on fighter command as one desperate last attempt to break the back of the defense. And they just threw hundreds and hundreds of planes in wave after wave at the British airfields. The RAF threw everything back at them, which at this point included huge amounts of replacement pilots, some of whom only had 9 hours flying time and no gunnery practice. So, I mean, it must have been, I can't even imagine the terror.
Oh.
I mean, if you put me on any sort of machine with only 9 hours practice and then started shooting at me at the same time whilst trying to do it, I can't even begin to imagine the terror.
Saying, what, people had never flown?
Never flown. Oh, had 9 hours of flying practice. Which, if anyone who's flown a plane or knows anything about flying planes, is basically taking off and landing.
Yeah. God.
Now, there was a reprieve. I mean, God knows how many poor sods went up for their very first sortie and just never came home again.
Yeah.
Young, probably very, very young men. But the Commander-in-Chief, Air Chief Marshal Sir Hugh Dowding, who we love mostly because he was played by Laurence Olivier, who's so great in this film.
He is so good.
He had held back on releasing the several squadrons of foreign fighters, probably because the British always think they know best.
There is that. Yeah.
But he also felt the rather complicated and intricate communication system that was all about radio transmissions wouldn't work with pilots who didn't speak the same language. There's a very famous incident that is covered in this film where the Poles were basically kept in reserve doing practice runs.
Mm-hmm.
And on one practice run, the Polish fighters, who, by the way, were as if not more experienced than most RAF pilots, because they'd already done it in Poland.
Yeah, and the Czechs as well.
And the Czechs. And they, on top of that, were really pissed off.
Oh, mate. Yeah.
So pissed off. So they were on this training mission and they spot some Messerschmitts and they go, sod this for a game of cards. Let's go have it. And basically shot everything that moved.
Yeah.
And came back down and got in big trouble because they broke formation. And in the film, it's a little patronising because they're basically just screaming at each other in Polish and having a right old time.
Yeah.
While their leader's going, I say, boys, back in formation.
It is quite funny. And when they do come down and get a slap wrist from like the headmaster, they're all like going, oh. And then, but it's quite clear by the end of the film that they can all speak English anyway.
Yeah, and,
They just chose not to, or they can at least understand it, but yeah. They just pretended not to understand it.
So at this moment of high stakes, when both sides were enduring massive losses, which were unsustainable, at some point one side or the other would crack, and this is what the Germans were hoping for, Air Chief Marshal Hugh Dowding decided to throw in these reserves of Poles and Czechs. There was even one Jewish pilot from British Palestine. I mean, they were from all over the world. New Zealand, Canada, Americans.
Lots of Canadians.
And they threw them all in. And lo and behold, the very famous now number 303 Squadron, which was a Polish unit, were the highest scoring Allied unit in the Battle of Britain.
Yeah.
They just went at it. They weren't having it. And in fact, the highest scoring pilot, so I guess you'd call him an ace, was a Czech airman who flew for the Polish squadron called Joseph Frantisek. So these guys really made a difference. I don't know, maybe they should have been thrown in earlier, but maybe that was the exact right time to throw them in.
It was like throwing on a super sub in the 85th minute.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And it's just like, take the glory, boys. Yeah. It's interesting when you're talking about the Americans.
Go on.
Because the actual first American casualty of World War II was in the Battle of Britain. Billy Fisk was his name. He was hit in a battle with the Luftwaffe. His fuel tank was hit and exploded. He survived, but later succumbed to his injuries.
Mm.
And there's a memorial to him in London.
Oh, interesting.
So he is the first...
Airman casualty.
First American to die in World War II.
Wow. Mm. Interesting. At the height of this battle that has been raging now for 2 months, the Germans made the absolutely catastrophic error of deciding to move from bombing Air Force targets to bombing London. And this was the start of the Blitz, or what we now know as the Blitz. And they switched to night flying, which was a lot more successful than what they were trying to do during the day. Much harder to find planes and shoot them down at night when you can't see them.
Yeah, that's called the Knickerbein. Do you know that?
No.
Strange name, isn't it? Knickerbein, mean translated as crooked leg. It's a code that allowed the bombers to work at night.
Oh, yeah, they had this special means of navigation.
Yeah, that's what the Knickerbein is, and it removes the observer core problem completely.
So, yes, in one sense, they were very successful at bombing the crap out of London and all of London's industries and railways. But once again, it gave the RAF just enough time to rebuild, regroup, rest, because exhaustion was another huge issue. These British pilots were basically taking off, emptying their magazines, landing, reloading, taking off again. And sometimes these pilots were flying 3 or 4 sorties a day. And they never knew when they were going to be needed. So they were constantly at this state of high alert.
Waiting for the bell to ring. So stressful.
Oh, I can't even imagine. And if you go online or you have any books about it, you will see endless pictures of fighter pilots lying in the grass. It was famously one of the most beautiful summers that Britain had ever had, and a long, hot summer too. So you see all these pictures of British pilots lounging around in the grass next to their barracks or next to their planes. And yeah, they were basically, they got it down to where they could intercept the enemy within like 4 minutes, mm-hmm. I think, from being sitting around playing cards to fighting. And that must have been psychologically really hard.
Well, to be
1 minute sitting with your mates in a countryside.
Dozing.
Mm.
I mean, I don't know what you're like when you wake up, but I'm useless for at least 2 hours. So if you've got to wake up from a little kip, not even have time for a coffee and a croissant,
yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't be able to live, you know, doing that.
Yeah.
So from waking up to being in the air in 4 minutes, I mean, seriously, I'm still rubbing my eyes.
I know.
It's crazy.
I would imagine the fear of imminent death would probably wake you up pretty sharpish.
That might do it. Yeah, maybe that's what I need in the morning.
There you go. That's what you need. You need a giant German shooting hot lead at you. That'll get you in gear.
Yeah.
So all of this builds to the final climax on September the 15th, which is basically considered the last and greatest day of the Battle of Britain. It's the day that we recognise as Battle of Britain Day. And the Germans were so roundly defeated, basically with a skeleton crew of fighter pilots who were probably beyond exhausted. The Germans had done a pretty good job, but not properly finished the job of destroying factories that were building ammunition and building planes, blah, blah, blah. And their losses were so heavy that 2 days later, Hitler, in a meeting of his Joint Chiefs of Staff, decided to call off the invasion.
Wow.
And Britain lived to fight another day.
Well, what's incredible is, so at the beginning of the Battle of Britain, the Luftwaffe outnumber the RAF in planes by roughly 2-1.
Yeah.
And at the end of the Battle of Britain, we have outnumbered them 2-1.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's absolutely incredible.
Well, as Sir Winston Churchill summed up very eloquently and famously, never has so much been owed by so many to so few. And really, there are lots of moments in the Second World War that you could describe as a turning point. Certainly, the Soviets driving the Germans back probably ultimately won the war as it stood right then. But as it stood in the summer of 1940, all of Europe was conquered.
Yeah.
No one was able to stand up to the Germans, and the Russians at that time were on the German side.
Well, they had a non-aggression pact.
Yeah. And they were tolerating each other.
Yeah, I mean, they clearly hated each other.
The Italians probably didn't really know what they were doing.
Well, the Italians were were very much with the fascists at that point, weren't they?
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, no, you're completely right. So basically, the whole of Western Europe and some of Eastern Europe is under the swastika. And
game over under the swastika. Like, there's no one left.
No, that's it. And it's just like, we're the last bit.
So, in terms of the outcome of the Second World War, this didn't decide anything. But in terms of where the world stood, holding its breath between the end of July and the middle of September of 1940, there was no one else standing up to the entire might of the Wehrmacht other than about 300 to 400 British guys in fighter planes.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
I mean, it is sort of astonishing.
No, it is. It really is.
I do a disservice once again. I did that generalisation, didn't I? I say British. British and Allied, because as pointed out, the Poles, the Czechs, the Canadians, the New Zealanders, the Americans all contributed, but there were very, very few of them.
And free French as well.
Yep.
As in, not just three French.
Not three French.
The free French.
There were more than three.
Yeah.
So it's an astonishing moment in history, not just World War II. And it did transform the way that the Second World War proceeded from that point.
Oh, big, big time. I mean, surely, whilst the world was watching Hitler and his cronies steamroll through everybody, it would have been a matter of time for the end of the war in the Germans' favour just would have seemed inevitable.
Yeah.
Whilst this holdback was like, wow, okay, he can be stopped. They can be broken. They are, after all, blokes
everyone else. And probably most importantly, in terms of morale, just a month earlier, you had the entire British Army fleeing in disarray, literally leaving their weapons behind and getting on boats and getting out.
Maybe that's where the hubris and the arrogance of the Germans at that point, prior to like them trying to implement Operation Sea Lion, comes from. The fact that, you know, they've kicked basically
everybody's ass.
And then kicked the BEF back home because, you know, with the tail between their legs. I mean, maybe that's where the arrogance comes from, because historians have said that they acted so arrogantly as if it was going to be a walk in the park.
And this is the start, I suppose, of military resistance.
Yeah.
Properly.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it's a great film to witness and describe a great event.
Yeah, no, and it does, all the things we've talked about are in that movie too.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, obviously, it could... To be honest, I think if it had taken a slightly more highbrow tone in places, because in parts it really is, it's top-notch. But if it had taken its time a bit more, I mean, there is so much aerial action sequences, which obviously that's where the Battle of Britain is fought, in the skies. But if there was a bit more... of like Dowding, a bit more Olivier.
The negotiations and the tensions.
Yeah.
I think
it would have given it just a bit more gravitas. Because you remember how when we're introduced to Olivier and he's walking down that corridor,
it's a great show.
It's going to be him. You can't see him yet, but he's got the voiceover. He's got like the kind of monologue.
He's reading the letter to Churchill.
That's right. And that is amazing. I mean, that's like great filmmaking. And you think, like, wait a minute, but it never really gets back to that kind of height.
Odd, isn't it?
You know what I mean?
I would say most of this film and most of what is really exciting, if you're a 13-year-old boy watching this, or two old men who think they're still 13, is that unlike a lot of other films that dealt with either the Battle of Britain or air war, there used to be a lot of actual footage or really dodgy models. This film, we talked about this, and I think it says at the end of the film, with the help of the Spanish army, which at that time in 1969 would have still have been the dreaded Franco, he must have had a pantload of German planes left, because this movie isn't real footage. It is not models.
No.
It is real Spitfires, real Hurricanes, real Dorniers, real Messerschmitts flying around shooting at each other.
It's amazing. And the aerial photography is out of this world.
And in glorious Technicolor Panavision.
Yeah.
It is epic in that footage. But Simon's right. There are these moments that are obviously deeply important, where the officers behind the scenes are trying to work out how to win this. But there's not as much as you would have, say, even in A Bridge Too Far, it keeps cutting back, doesn't it?
Oh, A Bridge Too Far, I think, is the highbrow ripping yarn.
And you're right.
The Battle of Britain doesn't quite make it because of that. And I imagine, though, that's been cut from, you know, that all went in the editing room.
Yeah.
Because it's still a long movie.
Oh, but, yeah, it is.
But if it was, say, half an hour longer or even 20 minutes longer and it just had that bit more... Because, put it this way, all the key players are in it, right? So Ray Parker Jr.
Ray Parker, drummer for, like, Status Quo.
So Keith Park, who's played by Trevor Howard.
Air Vice Marshal, yeah.
But... it's never really explained how important he is to the Battle of Britain.
No, he just keeps showing up in a plane.
He just comes out and look like he's dressed for decorating.
Yeah, he's got a like white jumpsuit on, hasn't he?
So, you know, you can imagine that in the original screenplay, it's based on a book by Derek Dempster and Derek Wood, on two different books, sorry, by Derek Dempster and Derek Wood. The Derricks, shall we call them. You can imagine, surely, in the original script, there's... an explanation of these blokes just showing up.
Yeah, there must have been.
Or is it that in 1969, it should still be so fresh in people's mind that you wouldn't have to describe exactly everything about them?
Well, it's very possible, because it was 1969. Let's see, that's only, amazingly, 24 years after the end of the war.
Yeah, so...
yeah, talk about fresh in memory. The people who fought in it would have gone to see this film.
Yeah, but also... you know, that there should be more description about those people.
Well, what's odd, isn't it, is that the film decides that one of its major subplots that it's going to spend a considerable amount of time on is the romance between Susanna York
and Plummer
and Christopher Plummer, who's a Canadian pilot, and we keep seeing them. It actually gets a bit repetitive, and they could tell the story so much more quickly. She wants to do her job, basically pushing little figures around on the giant map of southern Britain. He is basically sent wherever he's needed. He goes, I think they send him to Scotland.
They do
at one
send
point,
him to Scotland, yeah.
And he's a bit miffed because she's not following him. And she basically is Susanna York, who's absolutely gorgeous in this. Her point is basically, I've got a job to do, son. And you can't just make me stop doing my job because you want to get your leg over.
Yeah, I'm here. I've got to do my duty.
And he's a bit of a twat.
He is a bit of a twat. Yeah.
It's weird. He's really like...
it's all right because he gets burnt to death.
Well, no, he doesn't die.
Oh, no, he doesn't. God.
There's actually... we've sort of ruined it now.
I've got to start laughing about...
yeah, you got...
people being burnt. That's not funny.
But that does take up quite a bit of story time.
That's right. Cut that out. Put some description in on the key characters. Problem sorted.
I think they had Oscar-winning Christopher Plummer there, and we're like, well, we've got to give him something to do.
I think they, more to the point, they had Susanna York there, and it's just like, how do we get her in suspenders? And they managed to do it.
There's this
it's
scene.
Bizarre.
There's this scene. It's hilarious, where they're in obviously some hotel room, and she's putting some lovely silk nightie out on the bed. And Plummer's lying on the bed and he's like, well, what do you want to mess around with that rubbish for? He's really dismissive and mean. She's like, well, I'm quite shy. Meanwhile, she's standing there in thigh-high stockings and garter belt and a shirt.
Yeah, she's not that shy.
Not that shy at all. God bless her. Anyway, that does take up an enormous amount of time. Whereas our all-time favourite madman, Robert Shaw, we're never even clear when he dies, are we?
I don't think he does.
Doesn't he?
No.
Who is it that
Michael
we thought...
Michael Caine. Michael Caine dies.
Michael Caine. We forgot about Michael Caine.
Michael Caine has...
He's doing a bit of a Zulu, isn't he? He's quite well spoken in this.
Yeah, and Michael Caine has, like, I think he has top billing. Do you remember?
Well, he was a massive movie
that's
star.
That's what I mean. But clearly, he didn't really want to be in this film.
Yeah, because he died pretty quickly.
Because he's hardly in it.
We have, there's two mates, basically, who spend a lot of time sort of laughing at the youngsters who don't know what they're doing. And that's Ian McShane, who looks amazing. Many of you are like, Ian McShane, who's he? Well, he sort of had a whole resurgence in the HBO series...
Deadwood,
the psychotic innkeeper.
People in the States will know who he is.
Yeah,
he's big,
I'm just
there,
reminding
right?
them.
All right, sorry. He's also in American Gods.
Yes, that's right, exactly. So he and his buddy, Edward Fox, are very cravatted and quite botched.
Well, Edward Fox, one of my notes here on Edward Fox, even runs posh.
He does.
I mean?
He's legging up his plane in the poshest way possible.
But he is wonderful, Edward Fox.
Now, Ian McShane, who is without dispute a brilliant actor, does have a really moving little sub story too, doesn't he?
Oh, that's sad.
Because he's not actually that posh. He's an East End. He's like an East End lad, isn't he?
Yeah, he doesn't sound it though.
No, he doesn't sound it. But he gets leave and he goes back to his family, and they're not in a shelter. They're like in a church hall
it's
or
like
something.
A community
like,
hall,
a
isn't
community
it?
Centre in the East End, and he's with his family, and he's just arrived, and he's made his son a lovely sort of balsa wood Spitfire.
Well, I just wanted to quickly talk about that.
Go on.
So he arrives. And he's angry with his wife, but obviously so pleased to see her because she's come back. She's been they were evacuated probably to Somerset or somewhere like that.
Oh, that's right. She's come
somewhere
back.
Idyllic, but she got bored. God bless her. She missed the East End, so she, as the, you know, mum of the year, takes her two kids into the middle of the Blitz. Not very wise. And anyway, yeah, he brings this model that he's made of a Spitfire. And my note on this is. Lovejoy Spitfire. Rubbish!
Hush!
Then I've written, my T-34 looks better than that.
Yeah, Simon bought himself an Airfix T-34 and he made it last weekend and he's dead chuffed about it.
I can't believe you haven't put it on Twitter.
Yeah, but he made it. I'll put it on Twitter for the fans to see. But he made this whilst shooting down Germans over the channel.
It's rubbish.
Jesus Christ. Anyway... A fella comes in, he goes, we need some volunteers. There's some people buried under a house that have been bombed. And he goes, oh, I'll go. And he goes, I'll be right back. There's a really powerful scene where he gets to this bomb site and they're all digging away. And then the guy, the head of the air raid warden is like, shush, shush, shush. And there's this amazing moment where they all stop and listen to try and hear if there's any survivors under there. And in that silence, you start to see amongst the rubble, like a little kid and a parent. And it's and it hits, what you see happening with Ian McShane is all this blood and guts he's been experiencing in the sky is somewhat sanitized. Because as a lot of pilots said, you don't really see the enemy. Right. It's just a plane that you're shooting at, right?
It's a machine. You're killing the
machine.
You're
killing a machine, right? And even if you kill the machine, the pilot has a chance of getting out and surviving anyway. So it's a little different. And here he is seeing civilians killed. And anyway, he does his bit and...
No, you can't laugh there.
No, but...
You can't laugh here.
What I'm laughing at, which you've forgotten, is he's on his way back to the centre.
Oh, is this the crafty cockney?
Is the most cheeky, chappy kid who's actually... He's like, "Goo blimey!
Yeah.
How many of you shot down then?" Yeah. And he's like, "Well, quite a few. I bet you haven't."
Yeah.
He's giving him like, grief.
"You're not a Spitfire pilot."
Where he then,
Stoner Crow.
There's a lot of that going on. And he stops in front of the burning wasteland that used to be the
community center,
and you know it, all his family
are dead.
And it is a powerful moment. It's the one moment in the film where they show the civilian cost.
Oh, it's awful.
Of the war. I have to say at this point as well, Simon and I spoke about the John Mills Dunkirk, about the amount of moaning that goes on. Well, fortunately in this film, there isn't much moaning, except for the very first line.
What?
The very first line of the film. The film opens with a beautiful Spitfire arching through the clouds. It does a belly roll and then black smoke pours out of it. And the camera pans down to a refugee column somewhere near Dunkirk. Part of which are two Tommies sitting on top of a truck. And one turns the other and goes,
"Who the hell's he driving, kid?"
Referring to the Spitfire pilot who's just been shot down. It's like, "Oh, yeah, who's he then? Oh, Mr. Fancy Pants in the plane." First line of the film is a good, solid Tommy moan.
Yeah, it's got all the tropes, you know, the BEF moaning.
Mm.
It's also got the trope that you'd hope from seeing Robert Shaw in any film. The absolute terrifying intimidation of Robert Shaw
is there for all and sundry
to see.
Yeah, he's not happy with his new recruits, is he?
Well, let's just talk about that because, I mean, it's not a subplot, it's part of the plot. He's training people ready for the big day. They're going up in, you know, various missions. But a line I've got is that they all seem to be talking to each other over radio, which is obviously very unprofessional. And he goes over radio and goes, "Oh, shut up with you!" It's just like, you can almost hear him punching you through the radio. It's just God, he's scary.
You'd crash into the sea just so you didn't have to get out of your plane at the end of it and confront him.
Yeah,
I'd just
be flying into enemy territory.
The Hun's better than this.
Yeah, the Hun's better than Shaw. Anyway, and he's one of the people that he is in charge of who is just a flying debacle is a chap called Simon, which is unfortunate. So my namesake,
He's not very good at it.
He can barely land. That's when Edward Fox and McShane give it the whoops-a-daisy. And McShane says, "You could teach monkeys to do that," or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And
no, what he said, he also says, "Enough to make you weep."
Enough to make you weep. So
that's because this poor Simon's tried to land his Spitfire without putting the wheels down.
And clearly, Simon's a bit of an eaten boy or something like that.
And he's going to die.
Yeah, and it's so obvious that when it does happen, I was shocked because it's just like, surely it's so obvious that there's going to be some redemption here. He's going to be a hero. But anyway, that doesn't happen. A poor old Simon goes out with basically a panic attack, an explosion from Tron.
There's a couple of moments. Look, it's 1969, and I think they were really pushing the boundaries of special effects here. But what they would do, which is really odd, is they would have a real plane spinning down to the ground where it would hit the ground, and then they would superimpose nowhere near the plane a sort of an explosion.
Yeah, which looked like something out of like Space Invaders.
Yeah.
Or Tron, basically. Mm. It looked like Tron.
But we're sort of doing the film a bit of disservice. There are several brilliant moments.
Oh, the whole Kenneth Moore, Susanna York bombing. That bit is amazing.
Yeah.
The aerial photography there, that is incredible.
Well, there's a shot, isn't there? So basically, Susanna York is working at an airbase. And the siren goes off and they all think it's a drill. And there's this amazing shot where Kenneth Moore and Susanna York are like chatting. And he's saying, you know, it's really not very good. You can't have women in the men's trenches. This is not how it's done. And behind him, way off in the distance of the airfield, are these series of massive explosions as bombs fall.
Yeah, and then coming towards them.
Coming towards them. And then, of course, everyone legs it. And there are these shots from above the airfield, like obviously a helicopter shot or something, of just explosions all over the place. And it's absolutely fantastic.
It is amazing.
But in terms of performances, Simon and I stopped the film actually to talk to each other about it. There are a lot of brilliant actors in this, really brilliant actors. I mean, it's a who's who, this cast.
Totally. But
for his simplicity and his focus and his gravitas, Laurence Olivier is absolutely phenomenal in this. And he has probably one of the best entrances in film, let alone in war films, where his voiceover is reading this famous letter that Sir Hugh Dowding sent to Churchill, basically saying, if we don't fix this problem right now, not just the RAF, but Britain will be lost. And it's kind of a famous letter. And this voiceover is playing while we see this figure walk along this enormous long corridor somewhere in Whitehall. And as it gets closer, you realise it is the brilliant Laurence Olivier. Now, we can make fun of Laurence Olivier for some of those very early Shakespearean performances. I mean, his Richard III is brilliant, but it's eccentric.
Yeah.
You know, now it's the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by the son of York.
He plays Richard III like the Wicked Witch in the West, doesn't he?
But I can't remember whether this was before or after The Entertainer, which he's astonishingly brilliant in. But it is a thoroughly modern and brilliant performance. And we loved him, didn't we?
Oh, he was amazing. How naturalistic certain actors can be.
Mm.
And you completely take for granted, you know, someone who's totally in charge of their craft. Because that's what you're supposed to do, right?
Exactly.
You are supposed to not notice that somebody is acting.
Yeah.
But he is so good that he makes other actors in this film look like they're acting, and they're great actors too. That's how good he is. And I mean, he's phenomenal.
It's really powerful. Every scene he's in, and he's so simple. And it's not defeatist. That's the wrong word. But there's this certain quality he has about his character that he brings that character, which is a certain realism.
There's a true aura of melancholia there.
Yes, and an understanding of the stakes that are involved here and what is happening around him. It's worth it just for that performance if you aren't going to be excited by the brilliant planes whizzing around and shooting each other.
Well, speaking of which, the most famous scene in the film is the battle scene where basically suddenly the dialogue soundtrack fades out and in comes a piece of music by Sir William Walton, Battle in the Air. And you have this phenomenal, like, aerial battle ballet. It's absolutely incredible.
Well, the soundtrack is our favourite.
Oh, it's Ron Goodwin.
It's Ron Goodwin.
Did Where Eagles Dare. And our show's music, and our 633 music, Squadron.
Probably one of our most famous composers.
Ron Goodwin?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for film soundtracks, for sure.
Absolutely. This sequence that Simon's talking about, I think, is supposed to be probably what I described as the hardest day, which is what historians call this day, in September, where both sides suffered enormous losses. And as Simon says, there's been a lot of aerial battle footage. I mean, when I say a lot, an enormous amount.
Mm.
And unlike a lot of films you'd see where they would craftily try and repeat a few shots, you know, this is all fantastic stuff. And it starts with, as Simon said, this really excited jabbering on the radio, just people being like, "Bandits at 6 o'clock," and the machine guns firing.
Yeah.
And it fades out, doesn't it?
Yeah. And the soundtrack fades up. It's amazing. That's a brilliant bit of sound design.
Well, because the difference between Ron Goodwin's rather sort of, "Hurrah, we're British and we're fighting," which is what he does.
Yeah.
And this, I thought it was Vaughan Williams, actually, but it's Sir William Walton, piece of music. The music is beautiful and elegant and completely opposite to the film footage that we're watching.
Is everything up? A lot, sir. Reserves? None. That's what I've just told the Prime Minister.
I confirm hostile 4-2 moving north.
Request 611 151 squadrons to stand by. And please confirm cultural squadrons airborne.
So here's a little bit of trivia for you, Simon. So William Walton was hired to write this piece of music for this specific scene. And he was very old at the time, and he actually got help from Sir Malcolm Arnold, another composer, to assist him with the orchestrations, which he did. However, the producer, Harry Saltzman, rejected the score, basically saying that it wasn't long enough, which is amazing because this whole sequence is about 7 or 8 minutes long as it is. I don't quite know what he thought was supposed to happen there, but he didn't think it was long enough. And Ron Goodwin, who has most of the score of the film, was hired to write a new score. But he asked, when he found out that Sir William Walton had already done a bit of a score, he said, well, why are you asking me? Which is a perfectly reasonable question, seeing as one of Britain's greatest composers had already been chucked off the job. But it wasn't until Sir Laurence Olivier threatened to have his name removed from the credits if none of Walton's music was used. He basically threatened to pull his name from the project. And understandably and sort of predictably, Harry Saltzman backed down. And that's why we have this original music kept for the sequence called Battle in the Air.
That feels like it's made by somebody else, that section.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's just like someone else is doing this. Maybe it's just the director of photography, which is David Lean's right-hand man, Freddie Young. you know, and then, of course, the music gives it major gravitas. And again, it returns to the film that we see at the beginning with Olivier strolling down the corridor with a voiceover. It's that film again. It's just, there's just not enough of those moments to make it a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
No, I totally know what you mean.
It could very much, as I said earlier, but this sort of, this puts it into a better perspective. Instead of it being what it really could have been, it will always remain a matinee war film. A very, very good one.
Yeah.
But it's not a bridge too far.
No.
It's not a the Thin Red Line. It doesn't hit.
And it's post Longest Day.
Yeah.
And it's so, weirdly, it's not as epic in scale as that. But you know what you were saying about it almost looks like a different director. So there are these moments in The Longest Day, because they had
three
directors,
yeah,
you can almost see the differences. Yeah. Mm. It's not hugely noticeable because they did such an amazing job of it. But there are a couple of moments where you go, oh, that's quite powerful. And that's these moments that Simon's talking about. And amazingly, the sequence Simon's describing with this beautiful music by Sir William Walton, it ends where even that fades out and it's just silence.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's great. Just footage of planes exploding and fighting. And it ends with the pilots back on the ground, and the British pilots are back on the ground, and they look utterly defeated and exhausted and done for. And I think somebody says, you know, it's quiet, and you can hear for the first time the birds singing, can't you? I was very aware of that.
Oh, I think is Battle of Britain Day.
Oh, for sure. That's the end of it. Yeah.
There's that beautiful moment you're talking about when Shaw puts his like elbow out the window and he's looking out and looking all kind of like
wistfully at the sky.
Bizarrely, very Aryan, actually.
Yeah. Well,
but they're all kind of looking out, looking up at the sky, sort of looking at each other.
And the bell's not going.
The two sort of too scared to go like, have we won?
Yeah.
Because they're like, I think we've won.
They can't.
Do you think we've won?
Yeah, and they're not even saying it. You can tell, you're right, Simon. That's what they're thinking is, did we just win? Is that bell going to go again? And it cuts to a pile of life jackets. And you go, well, that's odd. And then one after another is getting dumped on it. And the camera pulls out and you see German soldiers marching away from their landing, their loading docks, and dropping off their life vests.
True. Great.
Which is a great thing. Because without any script, it tells the story. The Germans are not going to invade.
No. It's a great ending. It's a brilliant beginning, brilliant ending. That piece, the battle in the air sequence, is absolutely amazing. There are a few sort of parts where it tries its comedy hat on, and it's like, you could have left that out. Like when Edward Fox like parachutes into a greenhouse, and the kid runs out of a box of snouts, and he goes, "Well, thank you awfully, old chap." And it's just like, come on, you know.
Yeah, I think it's. Yeah, they decided.
It's just
to
like we all know that some English people are posh, right? You don't need to ram it home.
But then they did a similar where some English people are right old salt of the earth. Oh. So there's a bit where Ian McShane's going through the streets of London and some old geezer's turning to another and he looks devastated, like he's going to say my wife and kids are gone. He goes, they bombed a Rose and Crown. His local boozer's been hit, and he's absolutely in pieces.
I felt for him. In this film, you've got just two types of English people.
Yeah, there are only two.
Yeah, you've got people who are in the RAF who all talk like this.
Yeah,
and you've got street urchins.
Yeah,
and even the farmers, when a Polish pilot lands in a field, suddenly all the farmers are Cockneys. But this bloke's dressed full farm, isn't he? He's a farmer,
and he should be a bit all like that.
He should probably be like that boy, or you get off my land. But he isn't. And the Polish chap says, "Good afternoon." And he turns around and goes,
"Good afternoon, my ass, you bosh bastard."
I'm going to have on my gravestone.
Yeah. it's a really Cockney Kent farmer, which is a bit weird. And the poor Polish pilot, and this apparently happens a lot. And I think there were even horrible incidences where Polish pilots bailed out, landed, and then were killed by irate farmers with pitchforks because they thought they were krauts.
Really?
Yeah. They certainly were arrested every time they landed because old Kent farmers, they didn't know the difference, did they, between Poles and Germans?
No.
They all got funny accents, don't they? Oh, there was a lot of that.
Do you remember the chap who was in the Winter War, who I said looks like Adrian Mole's dad?
Stephen Moore.
Adrian Mole's dad. He looks like he's in this.
Yeah, and I've gone through the cast list and he's not. Weirdly, he might win most appearances in a war film without ever having been in one.
Yeah.
Because we keep thinking we've seen him.
Yeah, I mean, his finish. His Finnish language school, he did top trumps.
He was great in that. And of course, Kenneth Moore.
Oh, I mean, Kenneth Moore.
How many have we had so far?
Oh, that's a good question.
It's been a lot. It's at least three.
Is it really?
We're going to have to do a tally.
I don't know. I think Shaw's winning, isn't he?
Oh, do you reckon? I don't know that he is.
Oh, hold on.
No, I don't. What else is it? There's been nothing modern.
Hold on.
Yeah?
Oh, Michael Caine's winning.
For what?
Well, he's in this.
And?
He's in Dunkirk, isn't he? He's on the blower.
Yeah, well, it's not really in it, is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well, he is.
Kenneth Moore definitely wins it because he's in the Battleship one.
No, he's not.
Is he not?
No, that's Anthony Quayle.
Oh, I bet he is. I'm going to look get the cast
list out. I don't think he
well,
is.
Well, we'll talk about...
He will win, because, like, listen, I mean, I was going to save it for right at the end, but we've got to be pretty near the end. Is there anything else you want to bang on about?
Simon, what do we give it out of five?
I'd say it's 4 out of 5.
Yeah.
It's good, but it's not great. It's very good, but it's not great.
Yeah. I'm going to go 4.5.
Okay.
I think it's my favourite traditional war movie yet.
What, that we've done so far?
Yeah.
Right, yeah, yeah. Okay.
And enough. I mean, by traditional, the sort of shooting, blowing up, explosions, that sort of thing.
Boy's own adventure yeah. sort of stuff. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I hear you, totally.
So, Best Death Award?
Yeah, that one's tricky. There's obviously a lot of death, but it's mainly planes crashing, isn't it?
Yeah, so because everyone's in a plane, you don't really see anything. Christopher Plummer, he has that moment where... We don't actually see what happens to him, but his cockpit's on fire and he's trying to open his canopy and it won't open, will it? And his gloves are on fire.
But he doesn't die.
No, so that's not really a best death. The Rosen Crown, I'm going to say that's the best death.
Well, you don't see that either, but he clearly does die.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
The old fella's deeply upset about
it. As does all of Lovejoy's family. Oh. I bet he regrets making that model now. Yeah, what a waste of time!
What a waste of balsa wood. Probably spent a couple hours on that.
Yeah, and because we're now going to be doing so many Brit films during the Battle of Britain era, we can do best stereotypical Brit.
Yeah, there's only one winner for this.
Edward Fox.
Edward Fox.
Yeah, falling through the greenhouse. Bloke, kid comes out with a box of snout. Thanks awfully, old chap. Amazing. Whoopsie daisy.
Whoopsie daisy. He's so posh RAF. Yeah, it's sort of hilarious.
Yeah. Well, there's two stereotypical Brits, isn't there? There's him, and then there's crafty Cockney street urchin who's like, half a sixpence, governor.
Yeah. All right. So, and most stereotypical Nazi? It's Hermann Göring.
Göring.
I think when you've actually got Göring...
Yeah.
Hitler's right-hand man in a film.
Yeah.
He's always going to win
with all his get-up and his paunch.
And he gets quite angry, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Because he doesn't think that the fighter pilots are doing a good enough job.
Well, because he was a war hero, wasn't he? World War I fighter pilot. So he thinks they're all cowards.
That's right, yeah. So, there we have it. Any other awards to hand out?
Don't think so.
All right, then.
Best Intimidation Award, Robert Shaw, yet again. I mean, I don't know. It's like, Best Robert Shaw Award, Robert Shaw. Sure.
Yeah, he gets that every time. Listen, definitely, Simon had his fabulous Blu-ray DVD, and to be honest with you, it's worth it because... It really is glorious Technicolor Panavision, and it looks fantastic. Whack that up in your DVD player, put it on your big screen. It is fabulous to watch. And Simon's right. We were literally cheering and hollering and going, yeah, have some of that, you dirty Bosch bastard.
I mean, the beer might have helped too, but the film certainly did also. And then I wanted to talk about the next film.
Go on.
Well, we were just talking about Kenneth Moore. And you can never get enough more. So never fear, next time it's more overdrive in Reach for the Skies.
Come on!
So more RAF Blighty and the story of Douglas Bader, right?
Yeah, one of our most successful fighter pilots who, I don't think we're giving anything away, lost his legs.
Yeah.
But then continued to fight.
Yeah.
And was very instrumental... in trying to change the battle tactics during the Battle of Britain. So it's an important one. It's just a little another perspective on the Battle of Britain.
Yeah, I mean, we are going to be hovering around the Battle of Britain for a while. I think because we have to, obviously we've just done this one, we're going to do Reach for the Sky. We'll probably do The Few with David Niven about the building of the Supermarine Spitfire.
That's right, yeah.
And then...
Isn't there something called Spitfire?
Possibly.
Which I think
it's a very good tune called Spitfire. Mm. We could put that on the end of The Few.
Yeah.
And then we will probably do something about the 303 Squadron, the Polish-Czech Squadron. There's a film called Hurricane, which is probably worth a look.
And for those of you who are really interested in this, because, look, if you go online, there are probably more books about Battle of Britain than anything else in World War II. Just to name a couple of them, James Holland's Battle of Britain is considered a great one.
That's fantastic.
And there's an autobiography written by Brian Lane that's just called Spitfire, and it is a pilot's view. It's the view of a pilot who fought during Battle of Britain, and that's supposed to be ace as well. But there's so much out there.
There's loads.
Yeah.
I think Max Hastings has probably done one. All those boys, they're like a club, aren't they?
Yeah.
The war history boys. But the James Holland one's great. In fact, we should tweet a picture of it, of the book.
Yeah, we'll do that.
Of our copy of it, link it to him,
yeah.
And then maybe he can listen to our show. He'd be a great person
Let's
to interview.
On.
Yeah, he'd be a brilliant person to interview.
All right, Foxhole fans, we hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Foxhole Companion. And next week you've got Reach for the Skies to look forward to. More daring do in the skies over Britain in...
The Foxhole Companion!